When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, August 2nd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about M. Night Shyamalan's newest movie, Trap, and we'll present interviews with M. Night Shyamalan, his daughter, Salika Night Shyamalan, and Josh Hartnett. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editors Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
And Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, guys, let's get right into our discussion about this movie. Let's do some general thoughts, some non-spoilery thoughts, and then get right into some spoilery stuff pretty soon, because I don't really think there's a ton we can talk about without really kind of digging into the movie in a little bit of a deeper way. So just broadly speaking, Brad, let's start with you. What'd you make of this movie?
I enjoyed it for the most part. I think it definitely hinges on how great Josh Hartnett is in this role. He's clearly having a lot of fun. Chewing some scenery, really leaning into M. Night Shyamalan's sort of heightened thriller tone here. But I think my biggest problem with the movie is that it never quite outshines how great the premise is by itself and how well it's executed in the first half of the movie. And then the second half of the movie becomes a little bit of a different animal. And for me, I was particularly distracted by some very significant leaps in logic and a complete lack of common sense among several characters that occasionally took me out of the movie. And while I was still enjoying like the ride while I was on it, it was just the kind of stuff where it felt like Knight had this great idea for a movie and it made for a really suspenseful first half. And then he just couldn't write himself out of the corner that he put himself in for that first half and never really got a grasp on like where it should go next to really make sense and keep that momentum going. Mm-hmm. But again, for me, Hartnett, I think still made it fun to watch even when I was frustrated by certain things. And I didn't come away disliking it.
Yeah. I'm in the exact same boat. Actually, I underscore every single thing you just said there. Jacob, I know that you've mentioned in our Slack earlier today that you're pro the second half of this movie. So again, without spoilers, it sounds like those issues maybe didn't come up as dramatically as they did for us.
Yeah, this movie feels like a weird creative writing exercise where every 20 minutes, M. Night writes himself into a corner and it has to find a way out of it and repeat, you know, 5-6 times. And I appreciated and enjoyed the silliness of it all. So Trap's a very funny movie. Like, it's very intentionally funny in a way that I'm hoping most people will understand. I think a lot of this movie, its goofiest stuff, is very intentional. I think that sometimes M. Night's humor can be a little weird. As we discussed in the episode elsewhere this week, where we ranked our top 5 Shyamalan movies, he's a weird dude, a weird filmmaker, weird sensibilities. And Trap is a weird movie. And I enjoyed how that weirdness keeps cropping up here in very unusual ways. I mean, Josh Hartnett's essentially playing a Batman villain, like a Adam West Batman villain in some ways. Incredible. Chef's kiss. Bring back Josh Hartnett doing big, weird performances like this. I'm all for it. But yeah, the back half, which is completely unspoiled by the trailers, I won't spoil it here, is where the film takes a very, very big left turn. And it's one that I actually appreciated. In fact, there's one sequence in the back half that's my favorite sequence in the whole film that I thought was very funny and very intense in equal measure. It's a real killer filmmaking from Shyamalan. But I mostly want to, I'm jealous of what one of our writers, Bill Bria, said about this film. I'm going to just read his description from our discussion online. Trap is like a Brian De Palma movie, but instead of being a pervert, Edmire is the most dad guy ever. I think that sums up this movie very, very well, which is it has that extremely stylized, artificial, intentional look at me thing going on that defines De Palma's filmmaking. But instead of being a story of perversion and darkness, Edmire is a big goofy dad who wants to be a big goofy dad thriller movie. And yeah, I just, chef's kiss to Bill for summing it up in a way that I never could.
Yeah, in a meta way, this is kind of like the ultimate girl dad movie, because M. Night Shyamalan cast his own musician daughter as a pop superstar and built an entire studio film around the fact that people idolize her in this world. And it's like a very sweet thing to do, you know? And like from the outside, it seems like he has a really lovely relationship with his own children. But
this is a year where he produces his other daughter's first feature film. I mean, mm-hmm. Look, call it nepotism. I'm very, very hand-wavy on nepotism, because if I was a powerful filmmaker and I had two talented daughters, I too would use my power to put them on screen and get their movies made. So I say, M. Night, all power to you. Empower your daughters. Help them get stuff done. I find it very charming.
Yeah, personally, I didn't really find the music in this movie to be particularly interesting or memorable. And I was trying to think about this, and generally the most generous read I could make on it was that maybe you could look at that as some sort of subtle criticism of the kind of blandness of modern pop music or something. But I also didn't really find Salika Night Shyamalan to be an especially convincing actress, and I'm not sure that there's any read of the movie where that part could be read as an intentional choice. So no. I agree with you in spirit, Jacob. I find it charming and nice. I just feel like in this particular set of circumstances, that decision didn't necessarily result in the best version of what this movie could have been, I guess.
Here's the question, though. It would have been a better movie, yes, if there was a more convincing, talented actor in that role. But would have been a more interesting movie? I don't think so. I think Trap is more is more interesting than good. And I will take that M. Night interesting over anything, honestly, most of the time.
Okay. Well, I guess let's go ahead and get into spoilers. So if you've not seen the movie yet, this is your last chance before we get into some stuff that spoils things. Okay. I guess I'll try to open the floor here with this point. And I feel like, Brad, based on your initial assessment, you're probably going to back me up on this. For a movie that asks the audience to really invest in the physical, grounded, realistic question of, if I were this killer, how would I get out of this situation? There are an awful lot of moments in this movie that just are not realistic at all. And I really kind of bumped up against those in the way that it sounds like Brad did. But Jacob, what was your reaction to some of the decisions that these characters make and the way that the film really does try to drop you into Hartnett's character's shoes and say, all right, I'm clocking all the exits. I'm thinking through step by step how to get out of this situation. But then the movie kind of, I don't know, it loses its way when characters do things that are just not in tone with that, in line with that at all.
I mean, that's not an accurate observation. I mean, look, I'm very, very aware that I'm approaching this film from a place of lunacy. And that I think more people are going to be in tune with what you and Brad are saying here. But once I clocked in that this was essentially Josh Hartnett playing the Riddler in 1960s Batman mode, facing off against an army of the stupidest cops in movie history, I was on board for it. There's nothing to do with realistic. We talk about realism in M. Night in this week's episode about the best of his movies. And his utter rejection of logic and reality is a feature, not a bug for me. And I just watching maniacal Josh Hartnett effortlessly outthink every single cop in Philadelphia, all of whom are presented as being the biggest idiots imaginable. Just the fact that there's a scene where he puts on the earpiece with the stolen walkie-talkie and the FBI head is dropping exposition to every single person in the stadium. It's like, what is going on? It doesn't make any sense. But also, I wouldn't have any other way. Ben, I know I'm diseased and I'm deranged here, but it's for me, the film's utter rejection of normalcy is why I liked it. And so I know why you're saying what you're saying. You're not wrong. But I found myself completely on board with the film existing in its own weird fantasy universe where no rules of humanity actually apply.
I just wish that it picked a lane, you know, like if it committed from the beginning to be that kind of like bonkers lunacy that you're talking about, then I think I would have been much more on board with it. But the movie starts in a place of really expecting you to invest in it in a legitimate way and like put yourself in that situation. And then it just kind of goes off the rails. But I don't know, Brad, like what were some of the logical leaps that you had trouble with in this movie?
For me, it like I didn't have as much problem with like thinking that like the cops were dumb. You know, there's plenty of times when like those kinds of mistakes are understandable. And like for me, it was the second half where a lot of like the leaps in logic came from and like character decisions. And like, it's not just simple stuff of like when you're watching a horror movie and you're like, no, why are you going away by yourself? Or why are you running upstairs? That kind of thing. It's like it's stuff that just is the most immediate thought that you're having as to like why someone is doing something. Like, I have no idea, you know, why Lady Raven chooses to do a live Instagram reel instead of calling the cops herself when she has her own phone in her pocket.
I guess that's right now. It's because she doesn't have the information. She has millions of followers who are going to give her more crowdsourced information about where a Broken Lion statue is, as opposed to a cop who may not know.
I don't like this, Jacob. No, it's like there's also like the big turn where I was like, wait a minute, like I don't understand like what the end game is here, and it kind of does explain itself in a way, but like when he reveals to Lady Raven that he's the butcher. And then he thinks that he's just going to get out of the stadium and they're just going to get dropped off from her limo and everything's going to be fine. It's like, she's seen your face. She knows like this is going to be, it's going to be so easy to find you after this. And then of course it takes the turn of like, oh, she forces them to go to their house. So that way, like he can't get a chance to get away. And like, they know where he lives and everything. And even after that, I don't know how he continues thinking like he's going to get away. And eventually it comes to the fact that he's planning to just kill one more person and then kill himself, which is fine. But he wasn't always planning to do that. And he legitimately thought he was going to get away after they got out of the stadium in the limo. And I'm just like, nah, man, none of this makes any sense. And honestly, like the thing I think that was most frustrating to me in retrospect is that I feel like a lot of these problems could have been easily fixed if they just set the movie in like the 80s or something like that. Because then you don't have to worry about all of the technology that would have made it so easy for them to like catch him and like know who he is and all of that stuff. And so I feel like you remove technology from the scenario and you set it in something like the 80s. And I think that you'd be able to do it and have it be more believable and not have these crazy questions.
It's interesting because I was just reading on slashfilm.com earlier today, an article that I had somehow missed that we published, that Trap is like very loosely based on a series of real events where, like, I think it was in the 1980, it was in 1985, there was a like an FBI sting operation that sent a bunch of football tickets, like tickets to a football game, to a bunch of criminals. I don't remember exactly what the details were, but these guys like showed up and they like locked them in and arrested like over 100 people or something, I think. So and that actually was in the 80s. So that I guess I could see what you're talking about there with like removing the technological hurdles if they had chosen to go that direction. But I don't know. I have a few things that I wrote down. Like, in no world would this super fan daughter character ever miss a single second of that concert to wander around in the arena with her dad like she does in this movie. Like, I think more than any other character in the film, the daughter suffered from the feeling of a 50 something year old M. Night Shyamalan writing for a character that he didn't really understand very well. Like, there are these moments where the daughter is freaking out at this concert, but then other moments, like when Lady Raven says, I'm going to talk to your dad for a few minutes in this separate room. Okay, bye. Like, just stand here in this hall, where like the daughter literally doesn't react at all, which kind of feels insane because she's her biggest fan. And you're telling me she wouldn't be like, wait, what? What's going on? Dad, why are you going in this back room with this woman that I idolize? Like, I don't know. There were some character motivations and character questions that I had, especially about the daughter. But Jacob, I'm guessing that stuff didn't bother you.
You say all this like it's a bad thing. You say all this like it's a negative thing. Our own Chris Bendis described this as being, it's kind of filmmaking is M. Night in Silly Goose mode. This is the silliest goose's mode he's been in quite some time. And like I said, I'm a weirdo. I know I'm in the minority here, but every single time you mention, when you guys bring up these absurd choices and these things don't make sense, I start smiling a lot. I'm not frustrated by it. I'm really entertained by it. And my question is, how much, the movie's very intentionally funny. So the question is, how much of these ludicrous leaps of logic is part of the movie's sense of humor, and how much of it is M. Night not knowing that? I don't know. I don't know if the more ludicrous plot elements are intended to be funny, but for whatever damn reason, I was cackling with appreciation throughout this stuff. So I don't think you're wrong. I just think I'm a lunatic.
Brad, did you find this movie to be funny? Because I feel like there's been a lot of stuff written about how hilarious this movie is. And we even have an article up that says that this is his funniest movie. And like, you know, he's not necessarily a filmmaker that leans on humor in a huge way. So technically this might actually be his funniest movie, but I don't know. I wasn't really laughing out loud in this movie. Did you have that experience, Brad?
I definitely chuckled to myself. It has like some menacing humor to it, because, and most of it comes from knowing that Josh Hartnett, you know, is the butcher the entire time. And so for the first half of the movie, a lot of that stuff comes from just how he interacts with other characters, especially how he interacts with Jamie, the guy who works at the stadium selling t-shirts and stuff like that. Like,
oh, yeah, he was great.
Yeah, all the time that they were talking and everything. And just like the little thing where like you don't know what he's going to do. And like he hands him the knife, you know, to open the box, but then he gives it back to him. He's like, oh, here, don't forget that. You know, and so like, it was the second half. I didn't think some of the more ludicrous stuff that Jacob obviously enjoyed. It wasn't that funny to me, but I liked the moments when like he was able to like get around the cops and stuff like that. Like when he escapes through the tunnel and, you hear him as the voice who like tells the driver to get out and he hijacks the limo and stuff like that. You know,
you
and
liked that moment?
Yeah, honestly, like it was something where I was like, it's a ludicrous getaway for sure, but I liked how it was executed. It was a fun little moment of like, oh, here we go, we're still going. It doesn't make any sense, but I did like that moment.
I guess along those same lines, I wanted to ask you both a question. How purposeful do you think the trap scenario at the very end of the movie actually was? Like the two kids go off with Allison Pill's sister, and Allison Pill's character remains at home. And I think that somebody says that there's two squad cars out in front of the house. And of course, the butcher ends up inside and he very nearly kills his wife before he's ultimately lured toward a version of his mother and eventually shot with these stun guns. And I was wondering if you think it was always the plan that Allison Pill would poison him with that powder. The whole plot, that whole aspect of the movie just kind of felt really risky and really janky in terms of the execution there. But I don't know. Jacob, what did you think about that?
Oh, it's by far the weakest part of the movie, the final scene. It raises all kinds of logistical questions. And it once again, comes down to the fact that what do you want out of this movie? And it's very, very clear you and Brad appreciated the elements of like the clockwork mechanism of that first half. And I, once again, it just comes down to me being more willing to roll with the films, yes and, yes and, yes and. Because like, in the back half of the movie, it starts reaching like Return of the King levels of like, you know, oh, this is probably the ending. Oh no, he escaped again. Oh, here's the ending again. Oh no, he escaped again. And he keeps not escaping, and it's the dumbest thing, and I love it. But yeah, I do think that shirtless Josh Hartnett, armed with a cleaver, sitting with his wife eating pie for a very long scene, while the cops sit around twiddling their thumbs on this really bad, terribly executed trap plan, it raises a lot of questions. And if Josh Hartnett wasn't playing the Riddler, it wasn't being so goofy and entertaining, I'd probably be more down on it. But once again, I retreat back to my little comfortable nest of just being happy with this film's silliness and its embrace on style over any kind of logic.
I mean, we did get a shirtless Josh Hartnett scene out of it, so it certainly wasn't the worst thing in the world. But Brad, what did you make of that whole thing?
It kind of reminded me of The Negotiator and how The Negotiator ends, but The Negotiator is a much better movie. but like, yeah, it's a similar kind of setup where like they have, it's like this sort of like low-key sting that's basically set up. And it did feel like the cops were in on it, right? Jacob, did you think the cops were in on it too? Or like, was it just happenstance?
It seems very clear that the intention of the scene was that the wife was supposed to drug him and get him in a position to be tasered. But those cops are in a completely separate room, leaving her alone with a madman for a very long time. It's the worst plan I've ever seen from movie cops in maybe a decade.
Yeah, I think the most ridiculous example of the sort of logical stuff that I'm talking about is at the very end of the movie when Cooper, Josh Hartnett's character, has been caught. He's being led out of the house and he stops to pick up a bicycle that's fallen over in his front yard. And like, first of all, that bike looks way too small or young for his daughter, who was a teenager at that point. It looks like a bike for like a 6-year-old or something. And then second of all, the cops are just going to let this guy do whatever he wants? No, he's chopped up 12 people. Like, have they never seen a movie before? Of course he's going to take something to try to pick the handcuffs, you know? So I was just like, what is going on with the reality that this movie is asking me to buy into? I was just having real, mental trouble with that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that too. But then of course, like, I also did enjoy the reveal of them slowly zooming in on the bike tire and revealing that the spoke was taken away. And like, that was one of those moments where like I laughed to myself. I was just like, "Knight, you madman." and like I think that what it comes down to for that scene is I was, and this is maybe a problem that's on me and any other audience member who thinks about this, but this is an M. Night Shyamalan movie. So I'm waiting for one more twist. And sure, maybe him being able to get away again is that one more twist of like teasing that, like, oh, the butcher's gonna escape again. But like, I was waiting for like, oh, his wife's in on it, you know, like in on the scene, like when he's there and then she says something, you know, to him indicating that like she knew the entire time or something like that. Some extra layer that would have like added even more to it. But that never came, you know? So, yeah, I don't know. Like I said, that maybe is that level of disappointment might be on me, but like, you know, when M. Night has done this time and time again, you kind of, you know what to expect.
Yeah, I think I was waiting for something similar to really put this movie in a position where it would make me want to watch it again. And I think as of right now, like, I just have no interest in rewatching this movie. And maybe that's just an indicator of how much I liked. I mean, I thought this movie was fine. Like, I think Jeremy Mathai, who wrote the review, gave it like a 6 out of 10. And that feels about right to me, personally. But I don't know, because of these schisms, I guess, that I've brought up here, and because of the ending, I just think is like really ridiculous. I just don't really feel the urge to revisit this anytime soon. Maybe not ever. But I don't know, Jacob, like the high that you seem to get from the silliness of this movie, is that something that you feel like you're going to return to, or was this, did this feel like more of just like a one-off, like, oh, it scratched a little itch and now you're good moving on with your life? Or what do you think?
I'm not so sure. I'm looking forward to watching it again so I can answer the question for you, but it's so weird that I agree that 6 out of 10 is the right rating for Trap. Maybe a 6.5 if we can get in the numbers of it. But it's so funny to me that I am a very enthusiastic 6.5, or you're more of a, you know, I guess, I don't know, I'm also disappointed, but a little more measured 6.5 or 6. So it's just one of those things where it's like, I'm not saying this is a great movie, but I'm saying that like I vibed very hard on what was delivered here. And I think if you're a fan of old, if that level of Shyamalan weirdness, this Trap is going to be up your alley. This is, you know, not, this isn't a real movie like Knock at the Cabin or Split. This is absolutely an old movie. And as I discussed, you know, earlier this week, I'm surprisingly big on old. So, yeah, I don't know, man. I keep bouncing back to like the artificiality of it. The idea that M. Night's movies are so largely set in these little pocket universes where the rules of humanity, the way we speak, act, and make decisions don't always apply in his movies. And that it's so weird. And at some points, and films like The Happening, It kind of derails the movie because that film is way too much of M. Night Shyamalan's pocket universe. But I think Trap walks such a fine line where the way he sees the world and directs his characters and writes his dialogue is so specific and so odd that I don't feel mad or annoyed by how bizarre it is anymore. I'm just so refreshed that nobody's telling him no in a positive way. This isn't like laying in the water. Nobody told him no for a debacle. This is no one's telling him no because he's getting to be himself, man. And you know, I this is going to come down purely to how people feel about modern M. Night and how they feel about the choices he's made in the past 10 years of his career. You know, some duds, some not. A lot of big swings. And I think Trap's a big weird swing, man. And I had a good time with it. And I think a lot of people are going to watch the movie and be super annoyed. I love this big dumb movie.
I had a pretty good time with it too. I did actually love the scene where Cooper just confesses to Lady Raven and really like puts the ball in her court of like, what are you going to do about this? Basically, like I thought that was a great scene, a really cool power move that put the audience and that character kind of on their back foot a little bit. So I don't want to make it seem like I hated this movie. I just had a lot of questions and a lot of being like scratching my head and being like, really, what's going on here? So I don't know, Brad, I want to give you the opportunity, like since you and I are pretty aligned here, were there any other moments in this movie that really stood out to you that you really appreciated or that you loved or laughed at or that you wanted to mention that were sort of in the positive category?
No, honestly, like for me, the biggest thing was just, man, Josh Hartnett is back, guys. I hope he gets to like do so many more things after this, you know, between this and Oppenheimer, you know, he's having a good resurgence, and I hope that there's more for him because he's good here, and I think that he could really be like a significant, you know, character actor who just like pops in and occasionally gets these like lead roles like this where he gets to kind of like showcase a different kind of performance. Because yeah, he's really good here, and he definitely makes the movie more enjoyable in the face of some things that kind of like have you like distracted and pull you out of the story. So yeah, more from Josh Hartnett, please. You know, I was thinking too, like, and maybe it's just because it's a disconnect on my part. I feel like if M. Night made movies in like the 50s, that like maybe wouldn't be questioning these things. Like, it feels like he has a very like 50s sensibility, especially with this movie, because there's like I've seen several people comparing this to Psycho, which is very, very apt. And it's like it's a very Norman Bates esque performance and character. And I wonder if like, you know, if all we did was, you know, add some grain and make these movies in black and white, then we'd be like, oh yeah, M. Night Shyamalan was a great 50s filmmaker. Like if you take The Happening and put it in black and white and give it like, you know, a cheesy like horror score, like I bet you that would be a really fun B movie to mm-hmm. watch. Yeah, I don't know. That was just an aside that I had. But yeah, I didn't come away hating Trap, and I think it's worth seeing just to have fun with, you know, the craziness that M. Night puts on display here.
Okay, Jacob, any last words before we go to these interviews?
Yeah, I compared it to Psycho in a message. I was talking with the group earlier in our group chat. And one of my favorite things about Psycho is an often, you know, discussed scene is after the shower death scene, our main character's dead, and Norman Bates discovers the aftermath of the crime, and desperately tries to hide the evidence. He starts destroying everything, hiding parts, takes the car out to the swamp and sinks it. And there's this one of the most discussed moments in cinematic history, probably amongst film critics, is that he pushes the car into the swamp and it starts sinking, and then it stops for a moment, and there's a beat before it finishes sinking, and how as an audience we are now suddenly on Norman's side and our heart skips a beat when the car won't sink. And it's because the film has shifted its power. The main character has died and she's been murdered, but suddenly we're on the side of the guy who, through great performance in filmmaking from Anthony Perkins in that scene, and now Hitchcock, the director, suddenly has us like quietly rooting for him to get away with it. And Trap is that feeling stretched across a running time. I just had such a great time watching Josh Hartnett somehow keep us invested in him continuously getting away, continuously springing himself out of traps. And I love it when a filmmaker can push up buttons like that. And forever sloppy weirdness is going on around this movie in a sense of realism. That is still the core of this film, is the sense of M. Night winking and saying, hey, let's see how he gets out of this one next. And the fact that he's able to keep us on his side throughout that and invested in him, even though he's an absolute monster, is, you know, real magic stuff. And the core fundamentals of M. Night Shyamalan as a thriller filmmaker is a guy who understands how to put us in the POV of a character like that and ask us to be invested in their escape, even though our moral selves should be arguing that he needs to be caught in the first 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's a real technical bravura, you know, show of force that I respect, damn it. And so strip away all the silliness, stuff that made me chuckle, all the goofy stuff that I embrace just because I happen to like that. I think that Trap is really good at that. And that's something that I just have loved since I saw Psycho for the first time. I love it here.
Yeah, fully agree. Very, very well said. Okay, let's take a break and then we'll come back and present these interviews.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
Home Club for details.
All right, Jeremy Mathai had the opportunity to speak with three of the folks who were responsible for making this movie. First up is Salika Night Shyamalan.
So nice to meet you, Salika.
Nice to meet you.
So, okay, the first question I have for you. Yes. What's the Shyamalan group chat been like this year between you and your sister and the movies coming out at the same time?
Oh my gosh,
time?
It's been crazy. It's been so much fun.
Yeah.
Sean has made an incredible movie and, you know, her debut feature film, which is incredible. And we all spent a lot of time on each other's sets.
Right.
And so we were in Ireland, you know, when she was shooting and she came to Toronto and we're super close. And especially me and my sisters are like my best friends. So it's been amazing to kind of all experience these things together.
Yeah, that's great. I love that for you guys so much. That this past year,
my dad was just texting the group chat about dinner tonight because we're all in the city tonight.
So speaking of your dad, he did mention at the screening last night that, you know, this movie sort of came together as you two talking about movies mm-hmm. and music and kind of the intersection between.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that a little more? Like, how exactly, what were the origins of this movie?
Yeah.
Kind of coming together?
I mean, you know, we love music and film, right. You know, both and are inspired by both. And I think, you know, one, the idea of just within our own family and house that we could create something that has both elements done, you know, original and something completely new. And then also, you know, coming from Indian culture,
right.
Bollywood movies, they're like so, you know, the music is so integrated and like almost equal to the film and the
yeah.
plot. And, you know, we also love movies like Purple Rain and
right.
Once, where it's kind of built into the plot. And there's an album that you get to see kind of fully showcased. And so those were big inspirations. And sort of that conversation just started. And I did little projects for him throughout, you know, Old, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a Seven Songs for Servant.
Right.
And so as we were kind of progressing in there, it kind of felt more like we could actually do this. I think we might be able to actually pull this off. And then it just kind of grew and grew into this really crazy concept.
I love that for you guys. Now, one great thing about, you know, your dad's movies is that even a character like Lady Raven
yeah.
can become like an actual character of her own right, if,
mm-hmm.
you know, if that makes sense.
That's true.
The fact that she's so integral to the plot, was that something that was kind of there in the script at the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
like from the outset, or did that kind of like evolve over the course of, you know?
It evolved from the original concept. You know, it was like we knew there was going to be a concert and that she was going to be the performer, but
right.
how integrated it became kind of grew. It kind of became
okay.
its own like sort of second part.
Yeah. Shyamalan movies kind of tend to have, you know, kind of that small scope and scale to them
yeah.
sort of. So I kind of spent a lot of the movie wondering exactly how famous is Lady Raven supposed to be in the world of
yeah.
Trap? Is this like a Taylor Swift, Dua Lipa kind of situation?
Yeah,
or is
kind of how we were imagining. Maybe
okay.
not as huge as Taylor
sure.
Swift, who would probably sell out that same 10 nights in a row,
right.
but, you know.
So there wasn't like, I mean, was there any discussions about her backstory in the movie? Like,
yeah.
do you get in-depth in that with your dad?
I mean, I think musically, we were talking about there's a song that plays in the beginning that's, you know, a music video. We kind of imagined that maybe it was her breakout single on a previous album. Okay. And then, you know, there's a song with Kid Cudi at the end, and we sort of imagined that as another one of her breakout songs with a you know, a established artist who kind of believed in her and gave her a chance to make a song with him. And right. that song gave her a lot of exposure. And then, you know, kind of mapped out. We even made merch from like old albums and new albums. It was really fun.
Now, my last question for you is kind of on the representation side of things. Yeah. Because I was watching this movie and I was kind of like, if this is any other studio movie, I wonder if the pop star in the movie would have, you know, looked like you or me, yeah. you know? So was that, in your experience, compared to the music world, the film world, how, like, what is the difference between, you know, coming in and being yeah. sort of, you know, an Indian, you know, from that point of view?
I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing in this movie that, like, it, part of the fun of it was, like, imagining, well, there was an Indian pop star, right. like, you know, and getting to play that and then also incorporate Indian influences into the pop music, which I tried to do a little bit here and there mm-hmm. in a way that didn't ostracize people who right. maybe don't know that type of music, but also in a way that felt, you know, true to myself and the things that I love. So that was cool. And then even in some of the costumes, we had, you know, a little bit of Indian flares and things and the textures and stuff like that. So I love bringing that. And to me, like, representation is so important. And, you know, growing up, when I was young, I didn't see anybody that looked like yeah. me doing, like, anything ever. And I remember, like, when my grandma would come from India, she'd watch her Indian soap operas, and that was, like, the first time I had seen Indian people on screen. Yeah. And I was so shocked by that, and I was like, is this what, like, white people feel like all the time? This is amazing! Like, the lady looks like me and my sister. And so I think the more we can, you know, bring that into the world, the better.
All right, and next, here is Jeremy's discussion with star of this film, Josh Hartnett.
First of all, I wanted to put out that you were tremendous in Oppenheimer.
Thank you.
And of all the directions that you could have taken after that role,
yeah.
It was great to see you pop up in an M. Night Shyamalan movie, of all things.
Well, they're both terrific original filmmakers, yeah. and I've been super, super lucky in my career to be able to work with some of the greatest. And this, I mean, I've always wanted to work with Knight, mm-hmm. and we met years and years ago. We just talked about this as well. Like, I met him at a premiere. Right. You met him at a premiere. I ended up working with him, so now
hey,
it's your turn.
You never know.
I met him at the Village premiere about 20 years ago, or however long ago that mm-hmm. was, forever ago. And at the time was, I mean, I've been a fan of his since the very beginning, and told him, and then nothing happened for a long time. But then he came with this script, and first, you know, when you hear that Knight wants you to be in his film, you're like, yes, 100%. And then you read the script, and you're like, oh my God, this is gonna, if this goes wrong, it's all on me.
Yeah.
And it was a terrific challenge, but also I love challenges, so I was excited to be a part of it.
To follow up on that,
yeah.
because Oppenheimer, you know, you're kind of part of the fabric of an entire ensemble.
Yeah.
Here, you know, like you said, it kind of lives or dies based. Do you have a preference for, I'm gonna put you on the spot here.
Yeah, no, I don't think I do because In that instance, I was just so happy to be a part of that crew because mm-hmm. those actors were all amazing. Everybody was playing their roles to perfection, and like, you know, I could never do what Killian did in that role. Mm-hmm. Like, there was nobody was miscast. Everybody was perfect for their role, and to be in a film like that that has that sort of a scope, that sort of a reach, that you know, obviously it wins all those awards and stuff like that. But so many people see it, and it starts a conversation.
Yeah.
You know. It becomes part of the zeitgeist, and then of course the Barbenheimer weirdness,
oh, yeah.
and like it was just kind of, it was a magical sort of experience. And this one is a totally different animal, but in a similar way, like working with Knight or working with Chris, you're in a very inclusive environment where these directors are so at the top of their game that they want to collaborate. They don't have any fear of other people's opinions the way that some directors who maybe aren't quite as sure of themselves would like want to hold more tightly. And so I had a similar sort of relationship with Knight as I had with Chris, which is just very open and loving and like allowing me to sort of explore this very, very, very strange character.
Yeah.
Very different from Ernest Lawrence. And I just feel super lucky to be able to kind of, people don't know where to put me these days, so I can go all over the place
yeah.
and try different roles.
Now, I kind of want to jump off of that too.
Sure.
This character, like, you know, it's not a hero. It's not someone yeah. you're trying to garner sympathy with the audience.
No.
Do you enjoy, like, embracing that sort of challenge? Is that just completely different from what most roles ask of you?
Yeah, I guess I don't really care about garnering any sympathy from the audience. What I do want to do is make people understand why he's doing what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, it feels radical to try and do that because you don't, you know, audiences don't usually go along with the serial killer and empathize with him and start to maybe root for him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was the conceit of the script, and I wanted to kind of preserve that as much as I could, being Knight's actor in this. So I found the challenge kind of remarkable, but I want to play the character honestly and try to make it as credible as possible. Hopefully that will kind of lead to understanding and maybe empathy from the audience.
Now, personally, I would put M. Night up there with like Stanley Kubrick's, the Steven Spielbergs, of just how they act, how they, you know, get performances out of their cast.
Performances, but also just the way that they create tension, the way that they create a space, a mood that most directors can't. And there's like a world building that Knight's involved in that is very specific and unlike those other directors, but with that same sort of ability. Like, he's a genuinely genius filmmaker.
He's known for getting sort of these kind of off-kilter, very specific performances from his lead actors a lot.
Yeah.
You know, he has a very specific tone, and, you know, you kind of have to go with, and you play a large role in kind of setting that tone.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something that you guys talked about beforehand, or just, like, kind of nailing that, you know, threading that needle?
Yeah, we talked a lot about, like, how we could make the choices credible enough so that you believe that this guy who seemingly loves his daughter...
Right.
And we'll do anything for her, also the serial killer, and like not cheat the audience, be like, these two things exist. And for me, it was, he is, a lot of that stuff is a front.
Yeah.
And then the front bleeds into his reality, mm-hmm. which is something that happens, you know, like often I think with people who have, you know, kind of really intense sort of forward-facing fronts and their, you know, the reality of themselves is kind of hidden. Often they become that front, you know? And with him, he's sort of melted into that front so far that he started to kind of have something that's like love for his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But it's probably not love the way that you and I understand it. It's probably more just the way that she reflects onto him, you know, his understanding of himself. So it's probably, I mean, it has to be, if he's a psychopath, it has to be necessarily, like, narcissistic. But he's discovered over the course of this piece, like, and it's not just a character study, of course. This is supposed to be a fun movie. But from my perspective as an actor, it is. And so I feel like this is the day in the life where Cooper discovers that he's not completely a monster.
Hmm.
And that's an interesting role to take on.
Yeah.
Was
there any research involved in this? Were you looking into, like, making this as realistic as possible based on actual...
Lots and lots of books reading about people who are in jail right now for doing this exact same sort of thing.
And specifics and, off the top of your head?
Well, okay, yeah, I mean, like, so, I forget the name of this book because people have been asking about it, I should look it up. But I read a book early on that was about this guy going into the prison system in England, and there were a couple of serial killers there, lots of people who had committed crimes that were clearly psychopaths. And he went in and over the course of it started to advocate for one of them who thought it wasn't a killer.
Right.
And it turns out, of course, he was. He was just really, really charming.
Yeah.
And like and very convincing in his portrayal of innocence and his portrayal of just being a normal guy. And I was like, that's exactly what's going on here.
Right.
And hiding in plain sight and all that sort of stuff. It's interesting. I found the whole, like, the research of it was dark. Not something you want to do all the time,
right.
But something that worked really well for this character, and I think hopefully made the character fun and buoyant and real, and yeah.
Josh, you killed it.
Thank you.
Pun intended.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And finally, here's Jeremy's chat with M. Night Shyamalan himself.
So I'm ready to call this the summer of Shyamalan, between The Watchers and now this, and, you know, it's just a whole great family outing. Now, how much fun has this last beer been for you, for all three of you, and do you envision something like this happening again sometime down the line?
Yeah, you know, we're always talking about film and talking about art, and it's just the way the house is built, you know, and I'm careful to make sure that we're not talking about outcomes. You know, and you know, I always tell the girls things, you know, like, you know, the people that win the lottery, you know, have such a high rate of alcoholism, divorce, and all this stuff. You want to make sure that you don't label things good and bad. And so all of that's noise. So we have to just, you and your art form, that's it. And then everything else that'll happen as a repercussion of that is the correct thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be correct. So when you're writing your song, or you're writing your script, or whatever it is you're doing, you know. Concentrate on your craft in service of expression of the thing you're doing, the character or the thing you're trying to express. Concentrate on that, and you'll be really happy in life.
I love that. That sort of fatherly advice that you're given, even when you're Now, back when you were doing press for Old, I don't know if you remember this, but you and your mom released these clips.
Yes.
Of, you know, and she was, you know, trying to get people to go out and see it, and she hadn't even seen your movie yet.
She's hilarious, yes.
How are you going to top that for promotion for this one?
I mean, literally, I could just turn the camera on to my mom, and she will she will entertain you. An Old, I did this thing, as you were referencing, where I was saying, Mom, tell them, you know, why should they come see Old? And then she said this, all these things, and she's like, oh, it's the greatest movie. And I was like, Mom, have you seen the movie? She says, no, not yet. And then I said, well, how do you know it's good? Because you're very good, and, you know, that kind of thing. And then I said, Mom, what's the last movie you went to? And she was like, Titanic. And so, you know, you're not much of an expert. She was laughing. But she's so great. Yeah, she's typical Indian mom.
Exactly. As someone who has the same dynamic.
Yeah, exactly. She's like, why doesn't the world, you know, and no matter what, it's not enough, you know, for her. They, you know, so sweet. I can't wait to see her after all this. Fill her in.
Now, I want to talk about the marketing for Trap specifically, because this feels like the kind of rare movie that kind of, you know, gave away the twist ahead of time that Josh Hartnett is, you know, the killer in the movie. Was that something that, you know, was kind of, you knew that was going to happen when you were writing the script? Or, you know,
That process? I don't really think of it as that. That's the premise of the movie. You know, so it's the premise of the movie that the thing is you're watching it from the point of view of someone unexpected,
right,
is really what the movie's telling you. Not necessarily a plot point, but his feeling, like what's unconsciously happening is you're identifying with him as you're finding out the premise of the movie. So that's actually the funky twist of it. It's not the information that he's in a trap or that he's the killer. It's that you are the killer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Now, I feel like a lot with, you know, with your movies, they kind of have this through line of characters, you know, being thrust into situations that they weren't expecting and then having to make hard, you know, even like moral ambiguous choices with that sort of thing. And this was kind of an inversion of that with us having to identify with Josh Hartnett's character. How much fun was that for you to write? How different was that from what you've done before?
You know, I've always had this kind of penchant for doing dark humor.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, oh, wow, should I be laughing at this?
Right.
This seems, you know... And I giggle at that kind of stuff. Even when I was a kid, playing, you know, whatever, making my other cousins scared. It's kind of, you know, that wasn't very nice, but it's funny, you know. Like, and so I have that in me, and I only started really fully embracing it. I think I did a lot of humor in like, let's say, Stuart Little or Signs,
right.
But you know, and Signs was probably one that I added the most humor up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's my instinct now, and I from The Visit on, I've kind of added it into everything. And I think it's a, you know, nervous laughter is a really fun thing. And because when we go see movies in the theater together, it's so joyous to hear everybody laughing. And then that turns into gasps, and that turns into screams and applause, hopefully, you know.
Now, my final question for you, because my friends would kill me if I didn't ask. The Village has kind of had this critical reevaluation over the years. I don't know if you're aware of that or not. You know, people are calling it your masterpiece, and, you know, it's great. I love seeing
that. Yeah, it's a lot of people keep coming up
to
me on the street.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a 4K or a Blu-ray release.
Yes.
Is that...
I'm on it.
You
I'm
are?
On it.
Okay.
I'm on it, yeah. No, that's my next thing. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. That's interesting. Yeah, I'm literally on it right now to get a 4K
release. Love to
release.
Hear that.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all of the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.